Matthew chapter 10 is integral in the lives of Christ's disciples. They have been following Jesus for an unspecified amount of time. And as we saw last week, Jesus now is calling 12 of all those who followed Christ, all of his disciples, 12 of them now by name, have been called to step up into greater level of commitment and responsibility, which will now create a little bit of separation between them and their contemporaries, between them and their associates. And God does that to people in a group, where upon occasion he points the finger, he taps you on the shoulder and says, time for you to step forward, take greater responsibility. I want to see greater commitment, and that means you stepping forward and leaving others behind. I want us to understand that Jesus operates the same today as he did yesterday. Now, as we begin, there are, and this is no surprise to you, there are several jobs available to mankind the world over, of which claim to hold the title as the world's toughest job. Lots of different things you could do with your life by way of vocation, and some are more difficult than others. There are several who claim that title, anything from airline pilot to astronaut, world's toughest job, all things from oil riggers to roofers, farmers, chefs, garbage collectors, morticians. Many of them would lay claim on being the toughest occupation there could be. Always near the top of that list is commercial fishing. If you've done any research at all, you find that that is a very difficult job, very demanding. It is laborious, long hours, hard work. It's also very hazardous. And yet, what I find interesting is that there is one occupation that never seems to make any of these lists, which has actually proven so difficult that even Scripture records men abandoning it in order to return to the much easier work, apparently, of commercial fishing. And that's the job of a disciple. Simply following Christ and serving God in the prescribed way. That proves to be too much for many. Last week, we took a look at what it would require of a person. What does it take, or what did it take in these 12 to be selected for this kind of a vocation in the first place? Jesus has tapped these 12 on the shoulder and said, time now for you to come up from among the disciples and be apostles. You're going to serve God in a different capacity. That required something of them. What was it? Well, as we saw last week, it certainly wasn't due to any particular, particularly natural talent or ability. These guys weren't, you know, it wasn't for their superior intellect, as if they had all gone through seminary training. It wasn't for their high social standing, as if they were all very respectable men in the community. These guys were riff-raff. Nobodies. We know their names now because they became something through this process. But at the time, believe you me, these guys, they had no credentials. They were just blue-collar, rough around the edges, wet behind the ears people, like a lot of folks that I know today who have similar opportunities to serve God. If anything, these guys were a powder keg of sinful human character. Uh-oh. You know what I mean by powder keg? What I mean is things could go terribly wrong. If they fall into the wrong hands, these guys would collectively bring Christ's mission to a halt and destroy the church in its infancy. Ah, and Jesus picks them because in the right hands, they had the capacity to change the world forever. And Jesus saw that, so he picked them. They were chosen, not because they were perfect, but because they were first available. You remember this? They were available, and they always had been. They made themselves available to Jesus by quitting jobs, leaving families, forsaking the world, even before their services as apostles were even needed, right? Jesus didn't need their help to heal the leper, but they were there to see it. Jesus didn't need any of their assistance in composing the Sermon on the Mount, but they were all there to hear it. They were available. They were available. And second, they were transparent. They were familiar with one another. They had spent enough time in the discipleship community that they were not only familiar with one another, but Christ had, of course, become, on a human level, familiar with them. These guys weren't guarded. They weren't holding too many secrets, right? They weren't socially withdrawn. They didn't need their me time. They gave it all of themselves to following Christ. Each one of these guys, for the most part, was an open book. So when Jesus was selecting them as apostles, there would be no surprises. Oh, they had weaknesses and they had sins, and some of them were worse than others, but Jesus knew from the very beginning what he was getting into. And he picked those 12 because he knew for the most part that he could handle it and navigate it and work it together, all things for good to the accomplishment of God's great will. So no problem, I'll take Peter and I'll take Andrew and I'll take James and I'll take John and I'll take all the rest of these mick-muck people. I'll use them. We'll get stuff done. He knew who they were. They were available, they were transparent, and third, they were reliable. They were reliable in the sense that Jesus not only entrusted them with great power to heal people of sicknesses and disease and to exorcise demons from their body, but he also entrusted them with great responsibility. Not just power and ability, but great responsibility. These guys would now become the face of Christianity and represent Christ himself. And so, how would you like to be one of them? The reputation of the church as it was and would forever be was at stake, and Jesus put it in their hands with all confidence. I trust you guys. You can do this. I will let people look at you and know much about me and the church and the trustworthiness of it. I have all confidence in you. Not only Jesus' confidence in these 12 men, but also God's endorsement, because God was the one who gave Jesus the 12 names to select. And so that was last week, but now we turn our attention to more practical matters. Not necessarily what it was about these guys that caught Jesus' attention and had him therefore bring them forward in greater levels of service to God, but what it now really looks like to serve God. Okay, this is what it takes to qualify, but what does the job look like? What can we expect, you? What can you expect when you step into Christ's service? The apostles here have accepted the position. Okay, I'll take the offer. Thank you. I'm now an apostle. But now it's time for orientation. And so Jesus is providing these guys with a job description. And certainly it'd look a little bit different perhaps from one to the other, but there are some parallels here that are worth looking at here. I mean, you shouldn't be ignoring these things because they'll play into your life and mine. The first thing that I want us to notice about the job description, what it takes to serve God, is the fact that Jesus doesn't let these apostles serve him however they want. Did you notice as we read the text this morning that Jesus is pretty detailed? He has demands to meet. He has expectations. He's very clear with them. Jesus doesn't pussyfoot around. Some people treat God as if he's ambiguous, but I'm telling you, we don't serve an ambiguous master that leaves everything up to the interpretation of the servant. He's a master, and he's in control of the operation, and he's going to tell you what he wants you to do on his mission, because it's his mission and not yours and not mine and not ours. So he has commands and demands that we must meet. You either get it right or you get it wrong. It's that black and that white. And I can assure you, each one of us will be judged according to how we rendered our service to God. And if we get it wrong, it won't be for Christ's lack of explanation. He's clear. He wants to be and will be served in a particular way. Keep that in mind as you move forward in your Christian life, especially if you're one with an independent spirit. This is a tough one. If you're one of those who just simply won't tolerate being under someone else's command, you always have a rub there, you don't appreciate it, you despise being told what to do, I can already predict what your future will look like. You're going to be tempted to redefine what it means to serve God. That's what people are. You see it all the time. Well, then I'm. You know, well, this is how I serve God, and this is how I do it. And well, but have you read the Bible? And are you doing it like the apostles did? Are you doing it like disciples are required to do it? Those who serve God, mark this. Those who serve God in this life, you and me, must have the capacity to take orders. And apparently there's something really difficult about that, because I've met people in the military who have a harder time serving God in the church than they ever did out there on foreign soil. And I thought that the military was really supposed to prepare people to take orders, but then they get offended when they find that the same is true in the church, that there's orders to be taken and expectations to meet and commands to be obeyed. It baffles me, but there is something very stringent in Jesus' approach to service. And I'm sorry to tell you this, because I know that it's very unappealing. It is unappealing. That's why it needs to be said. You need to know what you're getting into when you want to step forward in service to God. Jesus will give you orders in just about every area of your life. For these guys in verses 5 and 6, Jesus told them where to go. In verse 7, he told them what to say. In verse 8, he told them what to do. In verse 9 and 10, he told them what to bring or what not to bring. In verses 11 through 15, he told them how to behave. And in the next section, verses 16 through 26, Jesus told them what to tolerate and how to respond. Everything is calculated, and we're to take our marching orders from our commander, or we're a renegade, Rambo, gonna get killed fast idiot. Jesus has a map for his men to follow here. He's got a script for them to read. He's got a packing list to check, and he's got rules of etiquette to practice. And it makes me wonder if Jesus would have found any apostles if he had waited until the 21st century. Apparently, these guys were willing. I don't find many who are today. Where are they? Where are the men and women who will step up and serve Jesus like that? Because serving Jesus like this requires humility, but I think that pride has pretty much wiped out an entire generation of men and women who could have otherwise made a difference with their life. But because of their pride, because they can't take orders, because they won't do it like Jesus says, but rather insist on serving Jesus however they want, on their own terms, if they serve Jesus at all, they waste it. They waste their time on this planet, precious time that could have been used building a wonderful eternity for themselves and others. Humility is just too tough a job for some people. Just too tough a job. Jesus has called us to a very demanding life. Would we expect anything less? Jesus lived a very demanding life. He did nothing of his own. He did not go anywhere that he wanted to go. He didn't say a single word that he wasn't told by God to say. Jesus says, everything I do, everywhere I go, everything I say, I am under the full control of somebody else, and it's God my Father. And I believe that Jesus had a will of his own, but he always condescended to God's will. He always yielded himself to God's plan. You know this, right? The night of his crucifixion, what did he do? He prayed 3 times in the garden that God would remove the cup of judgment from him. Like, just please, God, if there is any other way, I don't want to do this. 3 times he says this. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours. Not my will be done, but yours. Do you notice that? He has a different will than God's. 2 different wills in view there. 2 different plans, 2 different desires. Jesus didn't want to die on a cross. Jesus didn't want to face God's wrath. God wanted Jesus to die on a cross and face the wrath. And so Jesus bowed to God's will. And so we understand that when we look at the life of Christ, but I want us to see it now as we look at the lives of the disciples, these apostles. Because it's one thing for you and I to go, well, that was Jesus, but I'm a human. Right? We're tempted to play that game. But what if, in the off chance it happened, men and women in church history have also done God's will without question, unflinchingly, under the total control of God, like Jesus did. What if that happened? Now suddenly we're accountable, aren't we? Because if they did it, certainly we have no excuse. And these apostles did. Let's look at the job they were called to take. Verse 5, the 12 Jesus sent out, and he commanded them, saying, "Don't go into the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter a city of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Jesus is telling them where to go and where not to go, and he's really limiting their scope of ministry here by telling them that they don't get to go outside the bounds of Israel. Israel's tiny. And remember, there's a whole earth to reach. There's a whole planet full of people to reach with the gospel. And Jesus goes, you don't get to go outside of Israel. He's confining them to a space that's actually not much bigger than St. Louis County, Minnesota, by square mile. And yet there's a whole world full of people to reach. And in Jesus' mind, he already knows that he's planning to take the gospel to the Gentiles, but it's not their job. You don't get to do it. So he confines them to a space of operation in their ministry that probably would have frustrated some of us. I know for certain that it would frustrate a few ministers that I know. Some people think big. They want to go out and they're going to save the world for Jesus. And some of us, we actually have the idea that we're going to do great things for God. And then God goes, actually, I'm going to have you do very small things for me. Let's see if you can handle that. Let's see if you've got obedience down yet. So I'm going to limit you severely. And some of you, you probably have felt the frustration of feeling held back in this church. You feel the frustration of not getting to go forward as far as you'd like and as wide as you think you're capable of going and reaching as many people as you believe you could reach if Justin and this church and God and everybody else involved who has authority over your life would just let you. And Jesus goes, we're going to see how things work out in Israel first. And by the way, don't worry about the Gentiles. I've got a dude, you know, just off stage. His name's Paul. He thinks it's Saul. It's Paul. I'll call on him when it's his time. That's Act 2. But you guys are Act 1. You have to stay in Israel. Jesus is telling them where to go and where not to go. Where they are allowed to minister is very small. Anything outside of that specified area won't count. Think this through, guys. Where's the practical application in this? Anything outside of what God has called you to doesn't count. No matter how hard these apostles try to convince themselves of otherwise, if they want their service to count, they're going to have to serve Jesus where he said it would count. Our job as servants of God requires submission. That's point number one. You can write that down if you need to, but you already know it, don't you? Serving God requires submission, letting Jesus determine where you serve and where you don't serve, what counts as service to God and what doesn't count as service to God. And believe me, Jesus has an opinion about that. And I'm afraid that some people in this room and some people in the church are going to lose their reward because although they serve God and they've convinced themselves that they serve God, you insist on defining the terms of that. What some people call service to God isn't service at all by God's definition because the places they supposedly serve aren't the places God has ordained for them to serve in. Well, that's my service to God. Are you sure? You serve God out there to the neglect of the places that it's most obvious he would want you to serve? How does this work? And I'll warn you that those who serve God only when it's convenient to them, their schedule, their location, you're only serving yourself. It isn't service to God. And though you might think it's whitewashed and pretty looking on the outside, God thinks it's disgusting when he looks underneath. these guys don't get to play that game. Why would we think that we do? Jesus doesn't allow it. He says, you will go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and you will not go to the Gentiles. You will not cross that border. You will not go to the Samaritans. You stay in these cities. You don't go to those cities. So again, serving God requires submission, which, by the way, would have been a pretty tough job for Simon the Canaanite. If you look at verse 4, you see his name. Simon the Canaanite was also a zealot, according to Luke chapter 6. If you know what a zealot, like an insurrectionist, these guys, he belonged apparently to a group of men violently opposed, lethally opposed to Roman occupation. These were the conceal and carry types. They would carry around a dagger underneath their garments, and they would shank Roman guards if the situation presented itself. They were assassins. They would stab those in the government that they didn't agree with. These were anti-establishment types. Simon was anti-government, anti-authority. He had spent a good part of his adult life cultivating a rebellious heart. And now he's got somebody over him with more control and authority than any Roman soldier ever did. His name is Jesus Christ. This would be tough for a guy like that. Hey, Simon, go there. Hey, Simon, you don't get to go there.
Oh, yeah, Jesus?
Oh, yeah, Jesus. You need to keep your spirit of rebellion in check if you plan on serving God, because serving Him requires submission. That's going to be a tough job for some of you guys. I know it is for me. In verse 7, Jesus says, and as you go, preach. And then, okay, because that's not enough, he actually gives them the script. And as you go, preach. And this is what I want you to preach. Here's your text. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. You know what our job is as servants of God? And this goes for anybody in the room. Our job as servants of God requires you that the truth of God be first and foremost on your lips. As you go, preach about somebody else's kingdom, about somebody else's life. Go preach about a different king. And one thing I know about people is they love to talk about themselves, and that's a difficult thing when suddenly everything is changing. You're to go and promote, not you. You're to go now and glorify with your words someone else. You're to go, and your job now is to make somebody else look good and to make somebody else's dreams come true and to exalt somebody else. You don't get to do that for yourself anymore. And you know what that requires? For these guys to go out and preach that the kingdom of God is at hand, you know what that requires if you look between the lines? Trust. Trust. It requires trust in Christ to speak the truth. Because for you to speak the truth that you're not yet fully convinced of would be a challenge indeed. How are you supposed to go and make this first and foremost on your lips when you're not even sure if the kingdom of heaven is at hand? How are you supposed to go and tell anybody about the gospel when you're not even sure if you believe the gospel yourself? How are you supposed to go and tell anybody that God is good and Jesus is wonderful when you kind of think he's a jerk? How are you supposed to go out there and try and convince anybody to follow Jesus Christ through this life when all you're doing in your heart is complaining about having to follow Jesus Christ through this life? You must trust the message for yourself that you've been given to share with others, which, by the way, would have been a tough job for Thomas, one of the 12, the guy who was still struggling with doubts about the truth of Christ all the way at the end of the ministry after Jesus had been resurrected. He's still vacillating in doubt. And part of the disciples' service to God was to open their mouth and speak the truth of the kingdom in public. And that's going to be a tough job for some of you guys, especially if you're like Thomas, still vacillating in your confidence of the truth that you're meant to speak. Make up your mind. That's what I'm saying. Make up your mind. You're either in or you're out. You're either a believer or an unbeliever. You either serve God or you don't. It's a tough job. Jesus says in verse 8, heal the sick. Okay, it's not all doom and gloom. They get to do fun stuff too. And there's a bunch of fun. There's a whole list here. Heal the sick. Cleanse the lepers. How awesome would this be? Raise the dead. What? Like, that'd be a really sweet ministry to have in this church, wouldn't it? And what if we actually had it and Jesus gave the power to any of you that I ordained? And I said, you know, hey, would you like to be on the Raise the Dead ministry? What? Like, what would you do? Would you be like, no, I'm busy? You'd be like, yeah! Yeah, I've always wondered what that would be like. It'd be awesome. He says, cast out the demons. And there's a caveat. Here's why. Because freely you've received, and so freely give. Huh? Makes sense? What? This is amazing power that these guys are being endowed with. Some of the best gifts that Jesus has given them so far, really. The power to heal people and bring back the dead, all that. And you know what? You know what, though? None of it's for them. The best gift that Jesus has given them so far, and they don't get to use it for themselves. It's meant to be given away. Imagine some crazy scenario where some modern-day billionaire came up and just handed you $1 billion. I think you might be full of all kinds of emotions, probably confused, skeptical, but let's just say it was legit. You went to Super One and you bought a scratch-off ticket and it was $1 billion. And so there, you got your credibility. Because if it's on a scratch-off ticket, it must be true. So you got your $1 million and you're like, I got $1 million. But then you read the fine print and realizes that it comes with a stipulation. The only way to keep the $1 million is to drain it all by paying other people's hospital bills. Well, cool. But kind of not as cool as it was before. Our job as servants of God requires generosity. And that's cool, isn't it? But kind of also, at the same time, not as cool as if we could keep it all for ourselves. And that, honestly, is the attitude that some of us have. Thank you, God, for the blessings you've given me. Thank you for the job. Thank you for the finances. Thank you for the health. Thank you for the time. Thank you for the... I mean, we got lots of things that we bless God for, don't we? Thank you for this. God's given us a wonderful life. And wouldn't it be really cool if we could just hoard it? Just, I enjoy it. I get to enjoy it. But Jesus goes, no, you're to give this away. You're to be generous. You're to share. In fact, the best of the things that I've given you thus far are meant for other people. You're just the conduit through which it flows from me to them. You're just the conduit. Our job requires generosity, which, by the way, would have been a pretty tough job for Matthew. You remember his background? Tax collector? Right? Remember when we did a little profile on the average tax collector in Palestine? These guys were those who were hired by the Romans to do the dirty work, and they were kind of known for taking, not giving. They were trained, seasoned takers. They would, in fact, hire criminals and surround themselves with thugs who would take from you. And so suddenly Matthew is realizing that his new job as an apostle, because, you know, he quit the old job, and now he's working for Jesus as an apostle, and this requires a complete 180, an absolute about-face. And now he has to be generous. That'd be tough. That's what it requires, serving the Lord. Give away, what we've been given by Christ as an extension of God's grace to the undeserving. Go give what you have to the undeserving. Serve. That'd be a tough job for some of us. In verse 9, Jesus says, provide neither gold nor silver nor copper in your money belts. So don't take extra money or bag for your journey or two tunics or sandals or staffs, for a worker is worthy of his food. Jesus is stripping them of all comforts, necessities perhaps, everything that they would want, and I think in our minds, need. Like, you're sending me out without money? Where am I supposed to buy food? I don't get to take, in another account, Jesus says, don't take bread. I can't bring food. I can't bring sandals. I can't bring an extra coat. What if it gets cold at night? How am I supposed to stay warm? I can't bring... Well, it makes it pretty clear, at least Jesus is being clear with his apostles here, that their job as servants of God is going to require self-denial, right? You don't get to have these things. That's self-denial, which, by the way, would have been a tough job for Philip. And if you're wondering, well, how does Philip fit into that? Well, actually, Philip was one who, from what we can gather in the gospel accounts, was a man who had perhaps an unhealthy reliance on earthly resources. He depended on stuff that he had with him, things that he could take along, like food, money. So much so that Jesus singled him out on one occasion when they were surrounded by some 5, 10, 15,000 hungry followers. And Jesus asked Philip specifically, how are we going to feed all these people? And the Bible tells us that when Jesus asked him that, he asked him that just to test him, because Jesus already knew that he was going to do the miracle, you know, feeding them with 5 loaves or whatever. But he singles out Philip, who he knows has a problem in his heart of trusting in earthly resources rather than the endless resources available in God, and says, hey, what are we going to do? And Philip has a quick response and says, well, not even 200 denarii would feed these people. He had already had it calculated in his mind. This was just off the cuff. He's already like, well, you got 5, 10,000 people, yeah, a couple sandwiches a piece, maybe, give or take. And I was like, oh, that's 200 denarii, geez. And then all of a sudden, Jesus is like, how are we going to feed them? And he's like, well, 200 denarii isn't enough. I already thought it through. So I don't know. So you were worried about not having enough before you even were confronted by it. See, we're talking about this in class downstairs, where we tend to be, let's save people. We save, we have bank accounts, we hoard, you know, we gotta have our resources. Why? Well, we're not sure, but we might need them. Okay, Philip. Don't be surprised when Jesus tests you on that then. Because he doesn't like it when you fail to trust in his heavenly Father who provides us with all rich things to enjoy. The one with endless resources. He doesn't like that. He didn't like it in Philip, and so he tested him on that. Philip was one who didn't know how to manage without a plan, without provisions, you know. But Philip is going to learn in short order that serving the Lord requires more of him than his resources can provide. And Jesus is asking Philip to go beyond his means, and he'll do the same with you. And that will prove to be a tough job for some of you. In verse 11, Jesus says, now whatever city or town you enter, inquire who in it is worthy and stay there until you go out. And when you go into a household, greet it. If a household is worthy, let your peace come upon it. That sounds nice. Go into a house, and everybody likes us, and they like the gospel we have, and all is well. That's wonderful. And we should then accommodate them. We should accept them, embrace them. Our job as servants of God is going to require tolerance. If they will accept the message we bring, we tolerate them, we embrace them. And now, let me say this. The deepest relationships that you get to have now as a Christian, if you're going to serve God, are with those who respond favorably to the message you carry, whether you desire their company or not. They're a brother now, and you may not have liked them before, and you may not like them even now, but it doesn't matter, because if they trust in the same message you do, you're part of the same family. You have the same dad, you have the same brothers, and you have the same sisters, and that bugs some of us, because some of us don't really like some of us. But you're brothers and sisters nonetheless, aren't you? Guys, we no longer get to invest in people based on our own personal preferences. God gets to pick our friends. Serving God means letting Jesus pick our friends, which, by the way, would have been a tough job for James and John, who weren't exactly known for their hospitality. I spoke of these guys recently about how these two dudes, you know, they're ready to just, oh, Jesus ain't doing it like us, so they got it. Wow, you want us to break some fingers? We can get them to quit, you know. And Jesus has to stop. You guys are just hot-headed. And then, oh, these guys, they weren't too receptive, Jesus. Should we electrocute them? That's what it means, called on fire from heaven. Execution, right? They just they skip the trial and go right to the execution. And now Jesus has a real challenge for them, doesn't he? They wanted to see people die. And Jesus wanted to see people live. Serving the Lord is going to require you to build relationships with people outside of your comfort zone. People that you would love to kill, but Jesus died to save. You're going to have to learn to become brothers and sisters with those outside your preferred social circle. They may not be your age, they might not be your demographic, they might not be your skin color, they might not be, and Jesus doesn't care. That'll prove to be a tough job for some of you. In verse 13, at the very end of it, Jesus kind of changes his tone and says, but if the household is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And then he says, and whoever won't receive you or hear your words when you depart from that house or city, shake the dust off your feet. It'll be more tolerable in the day of judgment for Sodom and Gomorrah than them. You know what it meant to shake the dust off your feet? This was like a Jewish custom where when they would, against their best wishes, have to step outside of their own country, cross the border for some reason, into Gentile territory, they would, as a sign to the Gentiles of absolute separation between they and them, they would brush the dust off their feet, shake it off like this, so that they wouldn't carry anything back into their holy land that was corrupt and defiled, not even dirt. Your dirt isn't good enough for us. That was a real insult, right? And a very clear message. And Jesus says, now, you do this not any longer to the Gentiles, but any of your fellow Jews who won't receive the truth. So our job as servants of God doesn't just require tolerance, it also requires intolerance. This seems to be a tough job for just about everybody in the church in 2021-22. Jesus here is demanding his men to break ties with those who oppose the truth, no matter who they are. This could be friends. This could be family. And now you're called to insult them with your rejection of them, which, by the way, would have been a tough job for Thaddeus. You remember Thaddeus? Lebbeus? The guy with the multiple nicknames that he earned for himself for what would lead us to believe was a soft and affectionate temperament, just a kind of a sweetheart. That's a similar nickname. Lebbeus and Thaddeus means heart child. He was a real sweetheart, just loved people. And suddenly now he's required to communicate a stern message of divine rejection. Like, this guy is being called to communicate something to people that runs contrary to his own nature. And that's what it takes, because serving God requires us to not just open our arms to those outside our preferred social circle, but also to turn our backs on those who reject our message, even if they were in our social circle, whether it breaks our heart or not. That is going to prove to be a very tough job for some of you. Jesus says, "Behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. You gather that people are going to hate them." Jesus even says it later. "Therefore, he encourages them to be wise, like serpents, and harmless as doves." He says, "But beware of men. They'll deliver you up in councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You'll be bought before governors and kings for my name's sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles." This just doesn't sound safe, does it? And so I'd suggest to you that based on what Jesus says here by way of a job description, that serving God requires bravery, because serving God endangers a person. Always has. Google says that the fishing industry is the most dangerous job worldwide, with some 24,000 annual deaths. But it's not the most dangerous job worldwide. Serving God is, with an average of over 250,000 deaths a year for the last century. We have the most hazardous occupation on the planet, bar none, which, by the way, would have proven to be a tough job for guess who? Peter, who was so afraid of the risks of being associated with Christ, he cowers in fear and denied Jesus when questioned by a young girl around a campfire. Talk about cowards. Serving Jesus is going to require bravery. Take a deep breath, just quick, before I read anything else. Whew, right? Man, if this is the job, I don't want it. It's like these guys, you know, on the video. 24/7, I don't get to sleep, I get to eat lunch maybe, you know, like full on. If you had something going for you, you can scrap it all together because this is, yeah, okay, I'll just find a different job. And so many will. In the Christian realm, so many will just go on and find a different job. They don't want true discipleship, so they'll settle for, well, I guess false discipleship. But they won't call it false. But it's a far more watered-down version. It is so diluted that it hardly counts if it does at all. Nothing. They just won't serve God. They won't serve God. They'll make something up. They'll redefine what it means in order to cope with the guilty conscience that comes when one denies Christ. Now that we've taken a deep breath, brother will deliver up brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death, and you'll be hated by everybody because of me. But Jesus says, he who endures to the end will be saved. Hang on to that promise. He says, when they persecute you in this city, flee to another. Assuredly, I say to you that you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. And then a disciple is not above his teacher or a servant above his master. It is enough for a disciple that he be like his teacher. The end goal of our serving God is to be like Christ, our teacher, to be like our master. Our job as servants of God is to be like the one who hired us. That's the end goal. To be like Christ. That is the image from which we fell originally. And serving God in this life is our only hope of being restored to that image in any measure at all. Do you want to be like God? Do you want to be like Christ? Do you want to be perfected in this life? Then that is your hope. To serve God the way that Jesus prescribes, and that is a tough job, I will admit. I would contend that it is the toughest job in the world. It means having to be where God tells us to be. It means speaking as He instructs us to speak. It means giving away our best and living without the rest. It means letting Jesus choose our friends. It means learning to trust. And it's dangerous. And we're going to be hated. and we might get killed. And again, this is going to prove to be too tough a job for some of you, just like it was for Judas. Out of these 12, this was too hard a row to hoe for one of them. Judas Iscariot, who, by the way, was the one apostle who always felt himself to be more deserving than he was, above his master. It wasn't enough for him to be like his master. He needed to be better than. He was entitled. He felt himself to be a king and Jesus the servant. Instead of being betrayed on account of his service to Christ, as we read about in verse 21, Judas became the betrayer of Christ. We all betray somebody. It's just a matter of whether it'll be Jesus or ourselves. You've heard the saying, it's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. Serving Jesus is undoubtedly the hardest job on earth, the toughest of all occupations. It's why so many people quit, but that doesn't mean the job can't be done. It just means the right people must be called. Many are called. You've been called. But will you do it? Are you ready for this? Even now, Christ will be calling some of you to take the next step forward, which will require a bit of separation between you and your contemporaries. Are you ready to take the next step forward and answer Jesus' call? Because he has always been determined to find those who will work for him. Are you one of them? Are you going to serve Jesus the way that he wants you to be serving him?